From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in South Bend, Indiana last month. South Bend police officer Ryan O'Neill responded to a call about car break-ins. He encountered Eric Logan, a 54-year-old black man. O'Neill is white. Logan got out of the car, and according to police, he was approaching the officer when the officer shot him. Police say that Logan was holding a knife. Logan died in the hospital, and his family filed a lawsuit against the city of South Bend and the officer, citing excessive use of force. The mayor of South Bend is Pete Buttigieg, a Democrat who's running for president. Buttigieg canceled campaign events to respond to the crisis, and his campaign has been hampered by ongoing questions about how he responds to issues of race. 40% of South Bend's residents are black or Latino, and a study commissioned by that city found that the black population of South Bend has higher levels of poverty and unemployment than the country at large. South Bend is a city on the rebound, but not yet for everyone who lives there. This week, Buttigieg attempted to answer some of these questions. He released an 18-page policy initiative that he calls the Douglas Plan, in honor of Frederick Douglass. Buttigieg is calling for a broad series of political and policy reforms that would lead to a comprehensive and intentional dismantling of racist structures and systems in the United States, as he puts it. Could it work? Our guests are going to discuss it. In studio, we have Simeon Bannister, Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Simeon, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back, Evan.
And also with us is Adrian Hale, Senior Manager of Workforce and Economic Development and Education Initiatives at the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce. Adrian, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
There's a lot of different directions we'll take this because the plan does have a number of specifics and then it has some broad strokes as well. But I want to ask both of you from the outset here, is this the right kind of proposal? And is Mayor Buttigieg targeting the right kinds of ideas here? Simeon Bannister.
So I think one of the unfortunate dynamics here is that this plan is responsive to that scenario. And it really kind of, I think in some ways, given the circumstances, overshadows the substance of the plan, which as far as I can tell, looking at presidential races both this year and past, without getting into specifics on candidates, offers a fairly comprehensive set of solutions. And not only that, but offers interesting diagnostic tools in the piece and is sufficiently nuanced, I think, in some ways. Identifies the black-white dyad and attempts to get beyond that dyad. While recognizing the essential nature to deal with the problem of slavery and its history and legacy in this country. And so it's like I said, it's just to me a bit unfortunate that the circumstances in some ways overshadow the substance.
It sounds to me like what you're saying is it could have the optics of him responding to last month's shooting or these questions with a plan to sort of placate instead of a substantive plan that he might have proposed anyway?
I think we can all agree that it's time for us to have a discussion and a dialogue, both in this country and our society, in our community, frankly, that's meaningful and substantive about racial equity.
That's right.
The time is now, and it's just, again, that's exactly it, that it's just unfortunate that it appears that because of this very tragic event, frankly, one that keeps happening over and over and over again, in cities all across the country, that's the prompt instead of just a discussion, frankly, about why this is important, why it's necessary.
Okay. Adrian, what do you think?
So for me, I feel like it is a very good proposal, but it's not really new. The Urban League of America already had a plan called Main Streets Marshall Plan, where they call for very similar solutions to some of these severe forms of oppression and inequality that people of color face at disproportionate volumes compared to white people. I also say that I don't think it really gets to the heart of the matter because ultimately I think the greatest residual effect or relic of slavery is the fact that people of color have not had the ability to defend themselves against the wills of the majority. So when it comes to our self-determinants in regard to what our schools look like and how they educate us, what our housing stock looks like, what our job prospects look like, we have not had the ability to be self-determinant or defend ourselves against what others' wills for us have been. And I think that Pete, though I think he's well-intended and I think he is a very bright man, and I think to Simeon's point, it's a shame that he had to take such a aggressive and robust stance now as a presidential candidate post this tragedy in South Bend. There are other mayors across the country who stood up. Mayor Fry in Minneapolis is a great example, who came out with a multi-million dollar housing integration plan, okay, as a mayor. Pete has never done anything like that as a mayor. So to me, I feel like it would be better if instead of trying to take the lead to be this great savior for Black America, he could point to organizations like the NAACP, he could point to institutions like the Urban League and say they have been leading the charge on these issues for decades. And I will be a strong advocate and support in the White House.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've got Mayor Buttigieg's book, and you know, certainly he doesn't tackle these racial issues as directly as he is doing now in his presidential campaign. Though, to your point about whether it's Mayor Fry or others, Pete Buttigieg, as a mayor, did have a policy proposal. I think he called it 1,000 houses in 1,000 days that actually heightened the racial gap. And he has since acknowledged that.
Right.
So if there's something good that's coming out of this, is he's having a real reckoning on what policy the impact has had. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Simeon.
I think that's true. I think it's also just important to note, and you know, in presidential campaigns, things often get crystallized around the candidate. But I suspect that he had a lot of help putting this report together, and the footnotes for his plan suggest that that's the case. And so I think it's just important to recognize that there are probably lots of contributors that pour into a report that is as comprehensive as this one portends to be. I do think, though, there's something to be said for, and just kind of even getting away from a specific candidate, just kind of as you think broadly about racial equity and think about how we analyze, you know, the folks that say that they want to fight on behalf of these issues, to look for some of the clues, right? For example, I looked at Mayor Pete's leadership team. You know, we're talking about diversity in the White House, talking about diversity in a potential administration, but in the current administration, how does that look, right? And the same is true for a lot of candidates, particularly not the campaign staff as much as their actual governmental staff.
What's his leadership team look like?
So right now, the majority of folks that are in leadership roles, he's got some diversity at some of the lower levels. The administrative assistant in the office, the community outreach person. But it's really important, I think, when we start seeing some of the policy folks, when we start to see some of the kind of key decision makers, when there's diversity in those ranks, that really kind of speaks to a likelihood that, you know, obviously, as they say, past performance is not necessarily indicative of future results. That notwithstanding, it's important that we see that kind of diversity. And that's true, I think, across the board.
Let me bring in Robin Wilt, who's on the line with us, who's a member of the Brighton Town Board. First of all, Robin, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thanks. Thanks for having me join you.
Why don't you jump in with your thoughts on what you've seen so far with sort of the broad strokes of the so-called Douglas plan from Mayor Buttigieg?
Well, I think it is a comprehensive plan. I like a lot of the facets of the plan. I think that Pete Buttigieg is an imperfect messenger for this type of plan. As has been noted by Adrian Hale, I definitely look to his history in terms of what he has done as a mayor for Black equity, and I don't see a lot. And so the timing of this proposal is a little bit cynical to me. I know that his polling numbers in terms of African American supporters is very low at the moment. It's running between 0 and 2%.
Yep.
And so this is the type of thing that for him can raise his tractability in that regard. But these are not new proposals. These are proposals that have been circulating in the community and among other candidates who, in a lot of cases, go even further than any singular proposal that Pete makes. And, you know, again, he's a very imperfect messenger for this type of thing.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the specifics of what the so-called Douglas plan would do here. And again, all of our guests noting that in some ways these are sort of cobbed from other ideas and other sources, but they're trying to kind of collate them into one kind of a platform. So let's talk about economic dispossession and what you do about that. The plan calls for a $25 billion investment in historically Black colleges and universities and other minority-serving institutions. And He has proposed the Walker Lewis Initiative, named for black entrepreneurs Madam C.J. Walker and Reginald Lewis, that would aim to triple the number of entrepreneurs from underrepped backgrounds over 10 years. The plan would create a fund to invest in minority-founded businesses, offer loan deferments and forgiveness programs to black college students who start businesses after graduating, and increase the amount of federal contracting funding given to small business owners from marginalized communities. I'll start with Simeon. Sure. Tell me what stands out there to you and if you think that's enough.
So before we dive into the specifics, let's talk for a second about what racial equity means and the characteristics of structural racism that are absolutely critical to understand the nature of whether, or the likelihood rather, of whether plans would be successful or not. So structural racism, four characteristics really jump out at me. So the first is that structural racism is cumulative, right? It's about adverse outcomes as opposed to intent, right? Structural racism is systemic, and so it's the features of structural racism is that the ways in which it impacts systems, it's criminal justice, healthcare, and so on and so forth, leverage against each other to produce these adverse outcomes. And then finally, it's retrenching. And so the retrenching part is the really fascinating one to me, because retrenching, the characteristic of structural racism, is that you can make gains. It's possible to have, for example, the first African-American president and simultaneously have a criminal justice system that is grinding human souls, right? It's possible to have a first African-American president and still deal with an immigration system that is fundamentally broken and hurting the lives of millions of Latinx people that are either part of this country or coming to it. So it's important to recognize that it's not linear. And a lot of times we think about race as a linear construct, that it was bad and then now it's getting better and then it's going backwards and then it's getting better, but it's multifaceted, right? And so when we take a plan like what Mayor Pete has offered or what anyone offers, we want to test that plan to see how it addresses these characteristics of structural racism, right? How is it attentive to the actual historical context for what has happened in this nation, right? How does it attend to, for example, in a place like Rochester, very unique kind of community, very different community than a lot of places that we're often compared with. How do these plans address the unique circumstances? And so if we take the $25 billion plan for, I would say, frankly, that it's too small. Is really what it boils down to for HBCUs. If we take his investment plans for our entrepreneurs, some of the dynamics in the plan in terms of how we ensure that the resources are actually going to be driven to the local level and spent with the communities that have been most affected were a little bit fuzzy. Now, granted, it's a presidential plan. I mean, a lot of times the details don't get hashed out there. But again, how does that address the systemic features that have been so typical for structural racism? So I think, it's his framing, freedom, security, democracy, certainly presents a wide berth, and I think that that's important. And I think the sub features of the plan are there's some utility to thinking about voting rights and to thinking about so the comprehensive pieces on that end. To thinking about, I like the framing for security, that it's not just about, it's economic security and kind of thinking broadly about that. But again, my test for it is how do you address each of these features? And I think that while there's some great, there's a great start here, but it's certainly not a finish. And to his credit, he says that at the end of the plan.
Okay. Adrian, what do you think?
Just based off of what you just read out or the plan in general?
Yeah, on the economic side.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the economic side, I think at the end of the day, when you deal with business, you deal with very sovereign individuals. And ultimately, what I think the greatest barrier for his plan would be is how do you get other folks wanting to invest and to do business with entrepreneurs of color in a way that you don't necessarily see now. So to me, that creates an attitudinal challenge. You see it all the time now. I always like to say, in addition to what Simeon just said, is there was a rationalization, a normalizing, and a logic that was created in the oppression of people of color in this country, which is why the black condition is very different than the Hispanic or even the LGBTQ plus situation, even though those are also oppressed people, to also include women. Because we are a people who were not only enslaved here, but there was widespread lynching, open lynching, and the seeing of black bodies being completely destroyed and mutilated in public. So what happens to those mentalities or psychological pathologies that allow for that to exist? I would say that that's why today, even in the midst of a country that has an abundance, we are more likely to be okay or with normalizing Black substandard housing, Black subpar academic and educational outcomes, and all the other, you know, Black underemployment and unemployment, and then lower median household incomes, lower wealth, you know, wealth achievement. So ultimately, for me, when I think about the world of business and economic strategy, it's not how much money government would give to Black entrepreneurs, because ultimately government can just try to catalyze participation. It could just try to incentivize the work. But when the money runs out, have we done anything to shift the attitudes that didn't let or allow white entrepreneurs to think they needed to do business with Black entrepreneurs to begin with? And I would say, given the contemporary condition of the world of business, probably not.
If I could just riff on that, I mean, I think that that's an interesting point in terms of the ways that the kind of psychological baggage of slavery continues to show itself. And I think that that's an important characteristic, again, in the notion of this kind of cumulative nature of racism. I mean, I think it's also, you know, important to point out. I mean, I'm glad that Richard Rothstein, who wrote a great book that everybody should read, called The Color of Law, is coming to Rochester next week. Because the book chronicles the very creative ways that racism continues to morph, right, from generation to generation. The creative ways that we continue to see the same adverse outcomes, mm-hmm. regardless of the machinations. And so that's why, again, why it's important for, you know, any of, of these plans to try to attend to those features, those characteristics. Because what happens when, you know, if Mayor Pete were elected and was able to implement all of these strategies, it's not just like, you know, folks that are opposition are just going to sit back and take it and wait, right? And so the question is, how does a plan like this or any other plan that any candidate would propose have a life of its own so that it does result in the kind of cultural change?
That's right.
That allows us to be able to sustain a different perspective and then hopefully then different behaviors as it relates to race.
Well, so let me turn to Robin Wild and just ask, you know, sort of following Simeon's line of thinking there, can any plan, and not to be a cynic here, but can any plan that seeks to address a structural inequality change a culture, change sort of the attitudinal lines that created some of these divisions in the first place? Robin Wild.
Yeah, I think Simeon is absolutely right here. We are talking about reforming systems that have stubbornly refused to not be white supremacists at their very core, because these systems are operating in the ways that they were intended to operate. They were intended to benefit certain peoples within our society and then disadvantage certain peoples within our society. So in essence, we are inured to the disposition of the Black community at this point. And so when we're talking about reforming these structures and maintaining them and not re-envisioning them, not fundamentally changing our approach to these problems, we are not going to achieve the impact that we want. And the systems themselves are going to morph in order to benefit the people that they already have been designed to benefit.
I just wanted to piggyback on what Robin just said, because mm-hmm. she got at a very important point. And ultimately, you know, as somebody with a military background, I always think in terms of proportionality. Okay. And when you look at the way the origins of people of color began here in this country, it is astonishing to me that we have not had a real, meaningful, proportionate response in how to restore the conditions and opportunities of people of color in this country, to the degree of which it has to oppress and suppress Black people in this country. Now, and I'll just use this illustration to make it very clear. In the infinite possibilities of things that could have been done post-slavery, right? Ultimately, we are constrained in what is achievable because of the same justifications, rationalizing, and normalizing that allow this body, this Black body, to be treated as a subhuman for hundreds of years. You understand? Any legislative proposal has to clear that window of possibility. And we get legislation ultimately that is not reflective of what people of color have wanted for themselves, but of what a white stubborn majority has been allowing to happen or has been willing to allow to happen, which up until now has never been proportionate to the degree of discrimination or suppression or oppression that black people in this country have had to face and confront. And so what I like the most about his proposal is when he tries to get at the voting rights and he tries to get at suffrage, because ultimately many of these problems, and this goes back to the initial point that I made, it has to be led by folks who have an intimate knowledge of them. In addition to that, who are able now to formulate the solution. And I'll just say this really quick. When you deal with Black America, there has been a psychology that not only accompanies poverty, but has also been produced with the illogical conditions that we've had to be subjected to for a long time. And that's in the midst of prosperity and an abundance of opportunity that we've had to watch and not have access to. And so in order to really get Black America to be engaged and to want to cooperate into how do we, reintegrate ourselves into the American society in a meaningful way, you have to first address the war, I would say, we have been losing in all of our minds. But in particular, when you deal with the mentality and the psychology in Black America, it has been as a response to decades of oppression and decades of not being allowed to achieve your maximum potential.
And if I could, I know our guests want to jump on that. Let me just read our first comment from a listener that I think will help kind of reframe some of what we're talking about here. We're talking about real equity when it comes to economics, racial equity. Pete Buttigieg, who's running for president, has released an 18-page plan he calls the Douglas Plan for Black America in honor of abolitionist Frederick Douglass. And, you know, earlier in the hour, our guest said these points are important. They're not all new. In fact, there's really nothing new, but he's trying to kind of collate these plans into a platform that he thinks can work. They're a little frustrated that it comes on the heels of another police shooting, and I say another, in South Bend, Indiana, where Pete Buttigieg is from. One of our listeners says, well, of course Buttigieg's numbers are low in a demographic that has a traditional bent toward homophobia. And so if the messenger is flawed, the message is invalid. That kind of identity politics is killing the left. Let me ask our guest to respond to that by also pointing out one other thing here. The fact is, as Adrian Hale just pointed out, when there is prosperity, but there are entire segments of populations who aren't, generally speaking, participating, South Bend is billed as a city on the rebound, on the come, you know? And and yet Black residents of South Bend, in a city that is, you know, on the whole, revitalizing, they have more poverty and more unemployment than America at large, which goes to what Adrian's saying. And so when Anand Giridhar says, You don't ask hedge fund managers to help rewrite your laws about equality. You don't expect people who have been benefiting or have not solved the problem. I think it's logical for Black voters to look at Pete Buttigieg and say, as the mayor, you've got a city on the rebound, but you haven't done it for your whole city, so it's hard for me to believe it. I want to listen. I want to hear if you're there. I want to hear if you've solved some of your own issues. But I don't know about this listener saying, well, black voters are sort of anti-gay to begin with. I don't know if that's what this is about.
I just want to say one thing, and then I would love for Robin and Simi to chime
in.
The mayor of Chicago, the recently elected mayor of Chicago, a Black lesbian in an interracial relationship, got votes in all 50 wards. She won all 50 wards in one of the blackest cities in the United States of America. I don't think just the fact that he is a homosexual man has anything to do with his approval rating with Black voters. And I just want to say this as well. If that was so, with President Obama's large support for the LGBTQ plus community, I think that made major inroads in the Black community for acceptance in regard to the homophobic issues. So I just want to put that point out there.
All right, let me have Robin and then Simeon jump on that too. Go ahead, Robin.
Absolutely. I would tend to agree, since Ayanna Pressley, Representative Ayanna Pressley, has said many times that those who are closest to the pain need to be closest to the power. So when we're creating policy that specifically affects people in the black community, the black community needs to be in position to shape that policy. So that is what I mean when I'm talking about Pete Buttigieg as a messenger on these issues. If he had a record of working with stakeholders within the black community in order to address these issues within his own community, then he would be viewed as a plausible, a legitimate speaker to these issues. But that is not the case with Pete Buttigieg.
Okay, Simeon Bannister.
Yeah, so I want to take your listener's perspective and kind of flip it on its head a little bit, which is to ask if there's why there isn't any discomfort that all of the presidential candidates aren't talking about these kinds of issues in a sophisticated and comprehensive way. Why all of the presidential candidates aren't having a meaningful conversation about race. Why there's, I think, in some ways an attempt to constrain this conversation by trying to create this ridiculous, frankly, binary between identity politics versus the working class, as though they're somehow different, as though we're talking about different sets of people or different sets of issues or concern, when in fact we have to appreciate that the language about working class, similar to how it often happens in these discussions about race, becomes a proxy for white. And so I think it's important to acknowledge that tension. Every candidate should be as out front on these issues. And so, indeed, to Robin's point, he's Mayor Pete, maybe a flawed messenger. But the fact of the matter is, I know Robin would agree with this, he should still be talking about it, right?
Absolutely.
And so should Kamala, and so should Biden, and so should, Justin Amash, if he gets in, and all the rest of them.
Everyone.
Right? Everybody ought to be talking about these issues. Because, as Mayor Pete's plan notes, the facing nature of racism isn't just about the people that have been harmed most directly. The effacing nature of racism harms all of us, right? And just I want to give a concrete example for your listeners, just so that, because we've been talking kind of at the theoretical level. So let's talk about a concrete example right here in our community. So in Rochester, we know that there have been some meaningful challenges in many of our suburban towns, most recently crystallized in Pittsburgh around issues around race, right? That we have young people that are drawing swastikas on desks and all kinds of other crazy things that are happening. Now, if we understand education, it's not just a transmission of skills, but the transmission of values, right? What we believe, who we are. Then the same way that we talk about our public education in the system in the city as being deficient, we need to be having a similar kind of conversation.
That's right.
In our suburban towns. Why? Because we know that a key ingredient for us being able to move forward to fight for sustainability and climate change is the capacity of all of us to work together with different people, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we have a school system that is producing folks that can't do that, we are literally putting our planet in peril. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, this is like serious stuff. And so a lot of times we limit the racial conversation to just who was, interpersonally affected, as opposed to thinking about a broader level. And those are systemic and structural features that we need to engage.
Robin, you want to jump back in there?
No, I was. With regard to Simeon's point in education, we are failing in our mission if we are not educating the current student population with regard to race relations.
And if I could just say it, Robin, I mean, Pittsburgh's mission, because you mentioned failing our mission, like, as a concrete matter, Pittsburgh's mission is to help kids be their best, to do their best, to be their best, and to positively impact the lives of others. That is what the mission statement is for the Pittsburgh Central School District.
All right. So, listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about various proposals on the presidential stage, not the least of which is the 18-page platform that Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, calls his new Douglas Plan for Black America. It's a conversation about what ought to happen in regards to racial inequity on the economic level and across society. Our guests are discussing it. You hear Robin Wilt on the phone, member of the Brighton Town Board. In studio, we have Simeon Bannister, Vice President of Community Programs at the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Adrian Hale is Senior Manager of Workforce and Economic Development and Education Initiatives at the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce. When we come back, we'll answer a listener's question. Mark writes to the program and wants to know if what we're really talking about is reparations. And Mark says, as a white listener, he says he's for it. but he wants to know if that's what this is about. Well, we'll talk about that, because for a long time in this country, reparations was a word that was generally linked to, well, reparations for slavery. But as writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates have indicated, it's really about economic dispossession. And so we'll answer Mark's question, and we'll take more of your feedback. If you want to email the program, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind 50 years ago with the moon landing. We're going to take a look at the technology that allowed us to get there and the 8 years between JFK's promise and the actual moon landing. How did we do it? What do we really know about space travel at the time? And what does that tell us today? What are the next frontiers? Let's go to the moon next hour. This is Connections, and Mark emailed the program saying, as a white listener, wants to know if what we're really talking about is reparations, and if so, he's for some form of reparations. And Adrian Hale had some interesting comments about that during the break. Go ahead, Adrian.
Yeah, so first off, Mark, I appreciate you being for reparations, but at the end of the day, this isn't about if you're for or against it, or if you're doing me as a descendant of slaves a favor. It's really about the nature and the character of our country. And ultimately, the reason, to Simeon's point, why I think every presidential candidate should want to talk about these issues isn't about what are you going to do or not do for black people, but about how are you going to better perfect America? How are you going to ensure that the things that we declared on paper are actually put into practice in the way that we live? And in the distribution of opportunity that is in every facet of our society, whether that's in the halls of schools, on college campuses, or in the world of work. And so this isn't a favor or a handout to us. I think that it is self-evident that the impacts of the origins of my ancestors in this country are still alive and well with us. And even in some of the nature of the comments and the way that people think. And ultimately, I want to say this. America in general is woefully undereducated in regard to race and woefully underinformed on how it is still present with us today. And Simeon gave us a really good, quick little synopsis on the nature and behavior of systemic structural and individual racism and how they all interplay, interconnect, and are interdependent upon each other to continue to perpetuate the outcomes, these adverse outcomes on people of color, black people versus our white counterparts. So we all have to think broader than just the what's in it for me antenna that we all spout off of our heads to hear what is it about us. It's really about, I think John F. Kennedy said this, right? Ask not for what your country can do for you, and ask what you can do for your country, right? It's all of our responsibility to perfect America, and it's all of our responsibility to acknowledge the harm and the injury done to some people in this country in the past, and that we have to be intentional and deliberate about righting it, because time itself is not going to heal all of these wounds.
All right, Simeon, what would you say to Mark about reparations?
I'd say, Mark, I would actually encourage you to go and check out the Douglas Plan and actually read it. It says in the preamble that this actually is not about reparations,
right.
That this plan is not a replacement for reparations, but that this plan acknowledges that, the systemic features of structural racism need to be addressed. And that this plan does not say, here's a Band-Aid, or here's a gift, or here's a present that redresses a whole history of slavery and the kind of cruelty of slavery. Sometimes I wonder if people, Roots came out in the 70s, and I guess, I don't know if people fully appreciate what slavery was. Just as a comparable question, the kinds of tragedies that we've seen for which there's been remuneration. But it was an awful, it was an evil institution, right? And I would encourage people to, if they have some time, to go and read a book called Rituals of Blood by a guy named Orlando Patterson, so that you can get an understanding of both slavery and Jim Crow, the period that's known as the Nader, which is the period of dramatic lynchings in this country. Go back and read that, right? Mark, read that, and then call back and let's have a conversation.
Robin Wilt?
Yes, I would agree with Simeon. In the plan itself, it lays out that this is supplemental to any discussion of reparations. This plan is not comprehensive in terms of addressing the need for reparations. And I would also point out that that the need for reparations stems from widespread and generational theft of wealth and systemic oppression that is beyond the pale. We are not. We have sort of forgotten the ills of slavery, the evils of slavery, and we're also talking about an institutional legacy that has disadvantaged people of color for generations, and that's ongoing. We're talking about ongoing theft. And so, yeah, we need to address that. And like I said, with the current systems that we have, we cannot necessarily address it. So that's why we need to reimagine those systems centering racial justice.
Yeah, Robin used the phrase theft of wealth. And I think it's important that we speak in facts. And a fact in this country is, well, obviously slavery is a fact and part of the identity of this country. But it is also a fact that after the ending of slavery, a great portion of white America struggled so badly with that that it decided to continue to try to advantage power to themselves and stole wealth and stole property from black people, and largely continues to do so, but did that for decades upon decades. That is a fact. That's not, you know, that's not a controversial thing, or that's not like, well, there's a, you know, look at this journalist saying this, or this person is genuflecting, and that's just a fact. So the question is now, like, are we far enough, quote unquote, past it? Or, you know, Simeon, in response to some of what you said about a caller like Mark, what I often hear, Mark's at least saying, look, I'm a white person, but I'm for reparations. I often hear white listeners will say, this has nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't own any slaves. Like, yeah. There's no slaves. You hear that all the time. But economic dispossession and theft that Robin referred to was a fact and has been a fact in this country.
And what they don't understand is that they will still be the beneficiaries of systems and structures that just give them an unfair advantage. You understand what I'm saying? And that could start off with what schools they go to, the zip codes they live in, the lesser likelihood that their parents were incarcerated versus the parents of black children who grew up in single family homes, predominantly with their mother, who in the workplace is going to make less money than her white male counterparts. And so they don't understand that ultimately, and I think this goes back to the earlier point made from Simeon about the nature and behavior of structural racism, there will still be, whether you want it or not, there will still be an advantage bestowed upon you because of your identity in this country that will be denied, and it will actually be bestowed upon you at the expense of.
Right. I mean, keep in mind what we said about adverse outcomes. It's about the outcomes, not the intent, right? That you can mean good things and have a good heart and all that kind of stuff, but the negative outcomes continue to accrue. And I think that's why it's important. I referenced the color of law earlier, but I really want to encourage people to pick that up and to take a read, come out to the event, because it really does.
What's the event?
Oh, so sorry.
And by the way, can I read the book before next week and grab this person and bring them on the show?
Yeah, I would definitely suggest it. I mean, it's July 19th at the Lyric Theater. The Community Foundation is happy to be a supporter, along with Pathstone and other partners, to bring Mr. Rothstein to our community. Because, as Adrian, I think, referenced earlier, there is widespread ignorance about these kinds of issues, largely because in our space, in our society, A, it's the third rail. I think we've all known that. W.E.B. Du Bois diagnosed it as the problem of the 20th and now moving into the 21st century. So we all know that, right? But it's time for us to start unpacking this in a meaningful way, and that we don't even have to just talk about this at the kind of national level, but right here in Rochester, right? This was the community that had landmark cases around housing discrimination. This was the community that, if you go back for folks that live in Brighton and in Pittsburgh, some other communities, go back and grab your deed and look at your deed and see some of the restrictive covenants that are part of your deeds that prohibit the sale of your home historically to people of color, to Jewish people, to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Like, that happened in Rochester, not just somewhere magically else, not just in the South, right? In this community, the population in Rochester before 1950 was the non-white population was less than 2% of the Rochester community. Think about what that means. If Kodak and Xerox and Bausch and all these great companies and all this capital creation happened from 1910 to 1950, what you functionally have in Rochester is that people of color were never able to participate in that economic vitality. When they got to Rochester, those companies were on the decline. Right. And so now you have masses of people that have been locked into certain neighborhoods and certain areas. Literally, if you look at the redlined map of Rochester, it's the same neighborhoods that we all talk about today. Right. That's a result of policy decisions of institutions. One of the things that I'm grateful for is to work for an institution that has decided to place equity at its as a banner for the work that we do at the Community Foundation. Why? Because we recognize that in order for us to be a community that thrives and grows, we have to think about our actual history here and reckon with that.
So before I grab a phone call, in those communities that we're talking about, the redlined areas, we'll probably see more single-parent structures, a lot more poverty, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Robert in Fairport wants to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. And that, there really hasn't been one word up to this point about any kind of effort to try to shrink the percentage of single-parent families in the city of Rochester. If you look at African-Americans, the single-parent family rate is 80% in the city of Rochester. If you look at other ethnicities, for Asians, it's only 20%.
You think that has nothing to do with poverty, historic poverty, and economic dispossession?
I think it has quite a bit to do with poor decision-making.
Okay, so it's just black people make worse decisions.
I think that if you look at black people and you look at Asian people and you see a fourfold difference between those two ethnic groups, I think there's something worth studying there.
All right, stay on the line. Robert, go ahead. Simeon, I'll start with you, and we'll let all of our guests respond. Simeon Bannister.
Okay, where to start? So the challenge, Robert, that I want you to be able to kind of wrap your mind around is that we're all engaged in we have a connection point with our society, and that society helps to produce certain kinds of outcomes, right? And so, for example, in this community, your notion that this is just about kind of like bad decision making or poor choices, that choices are, they happen within a context. Can you appreciate that?
I can appreciate that.
Okay.
These rates are very different. A fourfold difference between ethnicities is huge.
That's not what he's asking you. Robert, that's not what he's asking you.
Yeah, so can you appreciate that they happen in a context? Right, this is, unfortunately, we've got 11 minutes to go here, and this is the kind of conversation that needs to be unpacked in a much more thorough way, because you need to see how the structures and the institutions that are in this community that deny access, resources, and leave people in, oftentimes in despair, right, leaves people in frustrating circumstances is ultimately what produces these kinds of outcomes, man. And I think the challenge is that, you know, sometimes we have a tendency to sit and to reflect on the personal experiences that we have had and to project those onto others in a way that just isn't accurate.
So, Robert, I just want to give you just a quick little synopsis of a couple of pieces of legislation and governmental programs that help contribute to a single female head of household in Black America. Number one, Simeon just told you about when Rochester had his largest economic boom, most people of color had not even yet arrived here. When we did arrive here, there was already an opportunity hoarding mentality that came through the world of work that kept most of us in jobs behind brooms in the Kodaks and Xeroxes. So for programs like government assistance, whether that's DSS, Department of Social Services, or WIC, which is Women, Infant, and Children, families would become ineligible if there was a male in the household. So that's first and foremost. Second to that, in around the 70s, because of this large spread of poverty, another assisted program by the government, when there was a mass amount of drugs infiltrating Black America, which we know that to be a fact as well, you were higher penalized if you had rock-hard crack cocaine versus the powder form of cocaine, and that ended up with something called mandatory minimums, which would take a Black male and put him in car and make him go to jail or prison, federal prison, for anywhere from 10 to 25 years. To life. In addition to that, in the 90s, you had something called the 1994 Crime Bill, which was a widespread mass incarceration and over-penalizing of even minor non-violent drug offenses, which destabilized communities and neighborhoods.
And in New York, the Rockefeller drug laws continue.
Yep. So there are various different reasons for large levels of single female head of households in places like Rochester and various other cities across Black America.
Let's just circle back around quickly.
Yeah.
So again, in these
and
2 minutes.
I just want to point out that these are all policy-based. The effects, these are the concrete effects of policy decisions that were made, of which largely the communities that were impacted were left out of. These underrepresented communities were not at the table when these policies were formed, which had a disproportionate impact on those very communities.
Then
they're getting blamed for the circumstances of those policies.
That's exactly. I mean, I just want to just unpack Adrian's first point about housing policy, just as a quick concrete example. I mean, think about that. That we have housing policy that says that if you are a male, you can't live in
with
public
your
with your well, yeah, right, with your family in public housing.
Yeah.
You can't be there. I mean.
Yeah.
Think about the implications that that has for what family structures look like, for them what people observe in terms of the communities around them, about how to sustain and build the strong family apparatus, right? And that did not happen, I would argue, by accident, right? Those are policy choices.
To Robin's point earlier, right, there, these systems function by design.
So Robert, what do you make of that?
I think it's nonsense. These rates have gotten higher over years. They've gotten higher as we move into the future.
Robert, where do you live?
He's at Fairport.
You live in Fairport. When is the last time that you had significant engagement with anybody in the city, in the neighborhoods that we're describing?
I do not have daily interaction with people who live in the city.
We know. Because if you did and you interacted with folks, you would appreciate that everybody wants the best for their kids, that everybody wants to put themselves in the best situation possible, that everybody wants to work and have the dignity of work, that everybody is willing to fight for and strive for their families, their neighborhoods and communities, but that circumstances undermine their ability to do so.
Right.
If you were spending time in the communities that you appear to know so much about, you would recognize that 80% figure is not because you don't get to 80%. You don't get to a number like that with people just making bad choices.
And we got to be very clear that
this is a result of structural conditions.
And I want to just say,
I think the problem is that a lot of the people on this panel are in a position to benefit financially from supposedly fighting whatever these structural conditions supposedly are.
Don't cut him off. Because that's really unfortunate, Robert, that that's the approach that you would take, right? Because, number one, there's no financial benefit for, I think, anybody that's sitting on this panel. You should actually take the time to get to know us. This is the issue, right? This is the challenge, that when we have an education system that is so fundamentally broken that it is not teaching people about the accurate history of what happens, you get folks like Mr. Robert here, right, who approach these issues in ways that are just totally off base because you don't have the benefit of the historical context. You don't understand how we got here. You have been trained, taught, and educated in schools that haven't transmitted the right values in terms of empathy, in terms of understanding, but even more than that, an actual understanding, an actual history of how we got to where we are.
That's right.
Because if you did, I can't imagine that you'd be on this show saying some of the things that you just said.
And I just want to make this clear to you, Robert.
And just so you know, our salaries, they're not contingent on
the existence of poverty.
So just, right. You know, FYI.
That ultimately individual effort and individual responsibility will never make up for mass systemic and structural adversity. It just won't do it. And I think that there's a whole lot of Americans who think that you are supposed to be able to just make all the right decisions and do all the right things, even when the systems that are supposed to be there to service you, the public institutions like school, like public safety and law enforcement, like your municipality, like the housing market, they are not there in a beneficial way to the communities that we're discussing here today. And I'm one of them, Robert. I grew up in a single parent household on Avenue D in Conkey on the northeast side of Rochester, New York. I grew up on every governmental program you could think possible, and I served my country twice. I went to a great school, and now I'm here working at the Chamber of Commerce to try to combat some of these challenges. And what I need you to understand is if anyone is going to use that argument, it would be me. But because I understand the complexity and the depth of these challenges and the effect they have on people and families, I know that there has to be a much larger, broader, more proportionate response to really help folks and give them the opportunity to do what Simeon said, which is want the best for themselves and their loved ones.
I've got to say, as we get ready to wrap the program, Simeon Bannister, Adrian Hale, Robin Wilt do not need the existence of persistent poverty for a job.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are not insulted by that comment, I certainly am on their behalf, because I'm sorry, Robert, but that is nonsense, to the notion that the guests on this program are relying on poverty and don't, you know, don't want to acknowledge just bad choices in the black community. Man, if you want to say, well, that's a political stance on the behalf of the host, I don't think it's political to recognize facts as Robin Wilt and others have laid out. The political issues are, what do you do about them? That's what we're debating, is the policy. And there are, you know, more conservative, if you want to put it that way. There's more progressive, whatever. But recognizing facts, if we don't have shared facts, then we're in real trouble in this country. Right. And I agree with Simeon. We all ought to read more on the Douglas plan. We'll post more on that if you want to read about it. There's part of the Douglas plan from Buttigieg talks about reducing mass incarceration by 50%. It's not easy, but it involves arrests, decriminalizing drug possession, and more. And yeah, we just barely scratched the surface. Here we are. Yeah. But
So Robert, if you go to the Community Foundation's website and check out the staff page, that's my direct number there. If you want to, give me a call. Let's have a conversation. And let's kind of explore a little bit of this together. And perhaps with some additional reading, we can kind of reverse some of the myth that you've received about how we got to the nature of the challenges that are currently confronting us in this society around race.
Now, that's Simeon Bannister from the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Thank you. Thanks for being here. Our thanks to Adrian Hale from the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce. Thank you, Adrian. And Robin Wilt, member of the Brighton Town Board. Robin, I wish we had more time as well, but thank you for taking the time for the program today.
Thank you for having us.
Short break. There's more connections coming up.